operations, with tutorials by real spies who were working in headquarters, HQS, after their operational stints in the field. During the first week of my interim assignment at a desk in the Southeast Asia branch, I got my first taste of life-and-death operations. One officer, a kind but gruff guy with years in Vietnam, heaped files on my desk and told me to read them and provide him an assessment. He needed to know how to dispose of escrow accounts for foreign agents with whom we had lost contact. The files revealed accounts heroic and heartless. One of the most disturbing contained transcripts of radio transmissions of a foreign agent cursing his CIA handler in a safe and distant venue as the agent and his recon team were overrun by the enemy. The dead agent had no known family members, at least none who were alive. I recommended that the escrow account be closed and the funds be returned to the U.S. Treasury. I also remember my first experience with a leak during this same interim assignment. In early 1981, I was appalled to see the headlines of the Washington Post that revealed how a CIA recon team was in Laos searching for U.S. prisoners of war from the Vietnam War. The story was true because I had helped organize some of the logistics from HQS. The team I knew was still in Laos. Still a long way from the Thai border and safety. How could this leak happen? And why would a U.S. paper print such a story? My next interim assignment was in Africa Division. I knew almost nothing about the continent, but I was attracted to the division's leadership and field operatives. They were a mixed lot, but mostly happy, profane, and uninhibited. Some within the clandestine service viewed Africa Division as the home for the most unorthodox and most iconoclastic officers. To others, the division was the backwater for misfits who could not function in more sophisticated environments. I served under a branch chief, a huge man wrapped in an even larger aura of charisma. He was one of the first CIA paramilitary officers deployed into Laos and worked with the Hmong in the early 1960s. He later served as Chief of Station, COS, in Francophone African countries. He demanded excellence, especially in communications. He expected initiative, even creativity. He also had no hesitation in heaping responsibility on young trainees like me. Sitting in his office, even smaller with his physical presence consuming so much space, he instructed me in how to deal with an incoming foreign liaison team sent to the United States for basic tradecraft training. It was a new intelligence relationship, and this was their first visit. The country's president would be arriving soon after the training was complete. For the branch, this was a big deal. I asked, "Who was in charge of this visit? Who was the control officer?" My branch chief responded flatly, "That would be you." I sat there knowing he must have lost his mind. I had not even been trained, and I knew nothing about Africa, certainly not this country, not this liaison service. I had joined the agency just months earlier. I had just started work in his branch. My branch chief watched me, waiting for me to say something. Maybe he wanted me to cringe or protest. I flashed back to an incident in Little League Baseball when I was about 7 or 8 years old. My coach, Mike Hodges, instructed me to move from the outfield to first base. I was incredulous and showed it. Mike responded with a look of impatience and anger, on the cusp of rage because I did not have confidence in his decision or in myself. I gulped down my fear and moved to first base, where I played for the rest of the season. It was a lesson to be remembered.
Yes, sir, no problem. Thanks," I responded with as much confidence as I could muster.
I started growing a beard. I assumed the name Franco as my first operational alias.
I surveyed the safe house and met the safe house keepers. I met with the instructors and organized the schedule. Then I met the foreign liaison trainees and escorted them everywhere. Somehow, over the next 4 weeks, I managed. I could not judge the effectiveness of the training or the operational or political impact. I had no reference points. I just served as an ignorant but dutiful escort. There was, I recall, only one surprise. During a late afternoon break in the training, one of the visiting students asked to speak with me alone. We moved to a small room in the safe house, away from the others. The student, with a grimace, pointed to his crotch and whispered, "My penis, it hurts." "I beg your pardon?" I asked. "My penis," he repeated. "What's wrong?" "I don't know," he whined. "Maybe you should look?" "Nope, that will not happen," I politely responded. "I only inspect my own penis. Let me get a doctor." The next morning, the CIA doctor examined the student. After a few minutes, the doctor exited the room and slapped a bottle of pills in my hand. "I gave him a shot. Be sure he takes these pills as prescribed." "Bad?" I asked. "Maybe the worst case of clap that I've ever seen." He patted me on the shoulder and hurried to his car. My foreign liaison patient soon joined me. I had never imagined this chore as part of my duty. I could not recall any briefings, books, or James Bond movies about this. With the bottle of pills in front of his face, I explained to the foreign liaison partner in slow, plain language, "You must take these pills every day." I rattled the pill bottle. "Or your dick will fall off." "Yes, yes, thank you, thank you," he stammered as he grabbed the bottle. My assignment in Africa Division afforded me more responsibility, with greater challenge and opportunity of all sorts, than I had imagined. It was much more than escorting some clap-ridden liaison partner around Washington. It was about access to a wide range of operational targets on the continent. Africa Division officers recruited Soviets, Chinese, Cubans, and even North Koreans, along with African officials, insurgents, and an assortment of other assets required for intelligence collection and covert action. It was wide open, particularly when compared with some of the other geographic divisions with large stations and more restrictive environments. Officers working behind the Iron Curtain, for example, performed courageous, important work, but depended more on structure and discipline than chaos and creativity. Africa Division officers in general thrived in fluid, unstructured, and churning environments. The continent attracted officers with entrepreneurial, unconventional attitudes. It was a division full of larger-than-life characters, like the late William Bwana Mosby, a stocky, muscular man with a huge handlebar mustache who embodied the division's values. Bold and unconventional in appearance and deed, these guys loved the mission, loved the risk. I wanted to be with them, to learn from them. After my interim assignment to Africa Division, I shifted with my class to the farm for months of intensive tradecraft training. The farm's instructors, except for a couple of unreformed alcoholics, ranged from good to excellent. They included seasoned officers like Gary Schroen, a South Asia expert who would lead the first jawbreaker team into Afghanistan after 9/11. Some had served as chiefs of station. Some were virtuosi in denied area operations, whose exacting tradecraft had kept operations officers and agents alive, most of the time. These instructors had worked in the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, and in communist countries in Asia. There, hostile services practiced extensive and sophisticated counterintelligence operations to thwart the CIA. Other instructors, many Vietnam vets, were paramilitary experts with more recent experience in Africa and Latin America. Some combined espionage talents with technical skills. Some were gifted linguists. A few, only a few, were consistent recruiters of productive foreign agents. This was true throughout the service. Recruiters were rare and highly valued. Over the course of many months, these instructors taught us the basic broad strokes of espionage. They lectured on the many aspects of tradecraft. This included coded messages, dead drops, surveillance, and counter-surveillance. We practiced on foot and in cars. We traveled to various metropolitan areas so we could maneuver in dense urban areas or scattered suburbs. I learned that intelligence is collected from many sources, such as aerial imagery, atmospheric signals intercepts, audio penetrations, telephone taps, surreptitious entries, and even open sources. The heart of intelligence, however, is human espionage. At its most elemental